Ever get that feeling when you find that one puzzle piece that like unlocks a whole section of the image?
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of what we're doing today, talking about those key pieces that help us understand the Bible, specifically the Old Testament,
right,
through archaeology.
Okay.
We are diving deep
right
into a lecture by Dr. Jeffrey Hudum,
who
is an expert in the field. And trust me, this is one lecture you would want cliff notes for.
Oh, I bet.
You know, so it's a...
It's fascinating how Dr. Hudum frames archaeology as this external lens.
Yeah.
Almost a fifth gospel.
Right.
That helps us view the biblical narrative with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
And it's not about replacing scripture.
Right.
But rather supplementing it.
Yeah.
With tangible evidence from the past.
And he makes this really clear distinction.
Yeah.
Between Old Testament and New Testament archaeology, explaining why digging up the past is more directly relevant to the Old Testament.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you're looking at empires, kings, battles, the kind of stuff that fills the Old Testament, you're going to find a lot more physical evidence.
Yeah.
It's like comparing finding the remnants of a massive city wall versus a small gathering place
right.
for early Christians.
Yeah.
One screams power and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The other requires a lot more detective work.
And speaking of detective work, Dr. Hudum doesn't sugarcoat the limitations. It's not like every dig yields perfectly preserved scrolls or pristine palaces.
Yeah.
He actually uses this analogy of a puzzle, but with 90% of the pieces missing.
Wow.
So what kinds of pieces are we working with? And how do archaeologists even begin to make sense of it all?
Well, some pieces are more common, like pottery.
Uh-huh.
And surprisingly, pottery is like a time machine in clay form.
Really?
You can tell a lot about a culture from their pots.
Oh, wow.
How they made the, decorated them, even what they ate.
Yeah.
Based on the shape and size of the vessels.
Sure. Okay.
Dr. Hudum actually contrasted the pottery styles of the Israelites and Philistines.
Oh, interesting.
And it's amazing how those simple clay shards can reveal so much about cultural differences and even power dynamics.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so pottery is like the bread and butter of biblical archaeology.
Yeah.
But what about those holy grail discoveries?
Oh, yeah.
The ones that send chills down your spine.
Inscriptions, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Hudum really captured the excitement of finding an ostracon.
Uh-huh.
Imagine a message on a piece of pottery.
Wow.
From a military commander just before Jerusalem falls to the Babylonians.
No way.
Talk about a front row seat to history.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
But then he mentions this conspiracy of silence when it comes to monumental inscriptions in the Levant.
Yeah.
It's like they're deliberately avoiding writing on stone, which is so different from what we see in Egypt or Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
What's the deal with that?
There are a few theories. And it's probably a combination of factors.
Okay.
One possibility is that they were using perishable materials.
Okay.
Like plaster.
Right.
For important inscriptions.
Yeah.
And those simply haven't survived the centuries.
So it's not necessarily that they weren't writing, but that what they wrote on has vanished?
Precisely.
Kind of like trying to read a message written on sand after a wave washes over it.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
But then we have those rare exceptions.
Okay.
Like the Tel Dural inscription found in Jordan.
Uh-huh.
They actually uncovered a plastered wall.
Wow.
Covered in ink writing.
Okay.
And guess what?
What?
It mentions Balaam.
Really?
The biblical prophet.
Wow. That's just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Okay, but before we get carried away, Dr. Hudum also cautions us about the potential for misusing archaeology. You know, it's not just about finding cool stuff. It's about interpreting it responsibly and avoiding those aha, I told you so moments that can sometimes creep into these discoveries.
Right. We have to be careful about imposing our own agendas or biases onto the past. Dr. Hudum stresses objectivity, thorough data collection, and consulting with experts from various fields.
Yeah.
It's about letting the evidence speak for itself, even if it challenges our preconceived notions.
He actually shared a story about finding a seal.
Okay.
And initially dating it much older than it actually was.
Oh, wow.
It's a good reminder that even experts can get caught up in the excitement and need to constantly check their assumptions against the evidence.
And that's the beauty of archaeology.
Yeah.
It's a constant process of discovery and reevaluation.
Right.
You're always learning, always refining your understanding.
Yeah.
Based on new evidence and new perspectives.
So with that in mind, let's walk through the actual process of an archaeological dig.
Okay.
I'm picturing Indiana Jones-style adventures, but I have a feeling it's a bit more...
It's a little more methodical.
Methodical than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's definitely a lot of meticulous planning and careful execution involved.
Okay.
Dr. Yudian outlined the steps from selecting a site and securing funding to obtaining permits and assembling a team of specialists.
Yeah.
It's a complex undertaking that requires collaboration and expertise at every stage.
So you've got your permits, your sunscreen.
Yeah.
What are you actually looking for?
Right.
What questions are driving the whole excavation process?
There are several key questions that guide archaeological investigations.
Okay.
First, identifying the site itself.
Uh-huh.
What was its ancient name?
Okay.
When was it inhabited?
Great.
Why was it abandoned?
Gotcha.
Then you want to determine who lived there, their ethnicity, their culture, their daily lives.
Right.
And finally, if the site shows evidence of destruction, archaeologists want to understand the cause and what it tells us about the historical events of the time.
It's like putting together a giant historical jigsaw puzzle, with each piece revealing a little more about the people who lived, loved, and fought in these ancient lands.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of puzzle pieces,
let's
talk about pottery again.
All right.
Dr. Hudon goes into fascinating detail about how much information we can glean from broken shards.
Yeah.
And it's way more than I ever imagined.
He compares pottery to classic cars.
Really?
And it's actually a brilliant analogy.
Okay.
Think about how you can instantly tell the difference between a vintage Mustang and a modern one.
Yeah.
Even though they share the same basic features.
Right.
The same is true for pottery.
Okay.
Styles change over time, reflecting cultural shifts, technological advancements, and even economic prosperity.
So just by looking at a piece of pottery, archaeologists can potentially determine when and where it was made and even get a sense of the people who used it.
Right.
It's incredible how much information is baked into those clay fragments.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
And Dr. Hudon provide some concrete examples.
Okay.
Remember how we talked about the differences between Israelite and Philistine pottery? Well, he explained how the presence of imported Cypriot pottery in Jerusalem provides evidence of trade networks.
Oh.
And cultural exchange across the Mediterranean.
Okay.
It's like tracing a physical connection between these distant civilizations.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've established that pottery is like archaeological gold.
Uh-huh.
But what about the tools of the trade? Are we talking shovels and picks, or is there more to it?
Shovels and picks definitely come into play.
Okay.
But modern archaeology utilizes a fascinating array of tools and technologies.
Okay.
Dr. Hudon mentioned theodolites for measuring elevation.
Yeah.
GPS devices for precise mapping.
Right.
And sifting screens for catching those tiny, crucial artifacts.
Yeah.
And then there's the guffa.
The what now?
The guffa.
The guffa.
Yeah.
That sounds intriguing.
It's a wonderfully practical invention, actually.
Okay.
Quite common in Middle Eastern archaeology.
Right.
Imagine a repurposed car tire with handles attached.
Okay.
Used for hauling dirt and debris.
Oh, so like a big bucket.
Yeah.
But it's a tire.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. That's pretty ingenious.
It's a testament to human ingenuity.
Yeah.
And the ability to adapt to whatever resources are available.
I can just picture a team of archaeologists
rolling
a guffa full of dirt across an excavation site.
Yeah, yeah.
Their faces beaming with the thrill of discovery.
Yeah.
It's a far cry from that sterile image of archaeology we often see.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me, what are the main methods they use when excavating?
There are two primary methods.
Okay.
The square method and trenching.
Okay.
The square method involves dividing the site into a grid of typically 5 by 5 meter squares.
Okay.
The key here is that they leave borders called bulks between the squares.
Yeah.
These bulks provide a vertical profile of the site's layers. Gotcha. Allowing archaeologists to track changes over time.
So it's like looking at a slice of layer cake, right? Yeah. You can see all the different layers and how they relate to each other.
And as you excavate deeper, these vertical profiles become invaluable for understanding the site's chronology and development.
Okay.
Now, trenching is a more focused approach used to investigate specific features or areas of the site.
Dr. Hudon mentioned the famous Neolithic tower at Jericho as an example, right?
Precisely.
That iconic structure revealed by a deep trench cut into the earth.
Yeah.
Okay, so both methods have their strengths.
Yeah.
And are often used in tandem
right.
to create a more comprehensive picture of the site. But isn't there a saying in archaeology that destruction is our friend?
Oh, yeah.
Something about destruction layers being particularly valuable.
As much as we might lament the destruction
yeah.
of these ancient sites, archaeologists do get excited about destruction layers.
Well,
they occur when a site is suddenly and violently destroyed.
Okay.
Whether by fire, earthquake, or human conflict.
So it's like Pompeii, where the volcanic ash froze everything in place.
Exactly.
Wow.
While tragic in their historical context, these layers act like time capsules,
mm-hmm.
preserving a snapshot of life at the moment of destruction.
Yeah.
For archaeologists, this means finding artifacts and features exactly as they were left undisturbed by later activity.
Okay, so we've talked about tools,
mm-hmm.
methods,
yeah.
and those fascinating destruction layers.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the sites themselves?
Right.
Dr. Hudon mentioned two main types of sites.
Okay.
Tells and curbs.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Tells are like those iconic mounds you see in documentaries,
uh-huh.
formed by the accumulation of centuries of human habitation.
Okay.
Imagine a city being built, destroyed,
yeah.
rebuilt and destroyed again over hundreds or even thousands of years.
Wow.
Each layer adds to the height of the mound,
okay.
creating a layered record of civilization.
He gave some great visual examples,
uh-huh.
comparing the towering tell of Beit Shan to the lower tell of Beersheba.
Yeah.
It really highlighted how tells can vary in size and complexity depending on their history.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And Selston offered a unique opportunity
uh-huh.
to study the long-term development of a settlement.
Yeah.
Tracing its evolution through different cultures, rulers, and even empires.
Right.
It's like peeling back layers of time, uncovering the stories buried beneath the surface.
And what about curbs?
Okay.
How are they different?
Curbs, also known as horvats in Hebrew, are essentially ruins with shallow stratigraphy.
Okay.
These are sites that were occupied for a shorter period
uh-huh.
and haven't built up the same multi-layered history as tells.
Okay.
Dr. Hudon's own excavation site in Jordan Kerbet Safra is a perfect example.
Right.
It's a city from the period of the Judges, remarkably preserved because it was never resettled after its abandonment.
So it's like a time capsule from a very specific period, untouched by later building phases.
Oh, exactly.
That must be an incredible find for archaeologists.
Yeah.
But before we go any further, I want to touch on something Dr. Hudon mentioned.
Okay.
About biblical chronology.
Right.
He talked about the work of Edwin R. Teal,
mm-hmm.
who basically revolutionized our understanding of the timelines in the Bible.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Edwin R. Teal was an Old Testament scholar.
Okay.
Who dove deep into the different calendar systems
uh-huh.
and accession year practices
okay.
used by the kingdoms of Israel and Judah.
Yeah.
His work helped resolve discrepancies in biblical chronology.
Gotcha.
Giving us a more accurate framework.
Uh-huh.
for understanding the events and reigns described in the Old Testament.
So it's not just about digging up artifacts.
Right.
It's also about understanding the historical context.
Yeah.
The different ways time was measured
mm-hmm.
and recorded in the ancient world.
Exactly.
And to help us with that context,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Hudon gives us a brief overview of the major archaeological periods relevant to biblical archaeology
yeah.
from the Chalcolithic or Copper Stone Age to the Byzantine period.
It's like having a road map to navigate the vast expanse of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And speaking of time.
Okay.
Dr. Hudon makes an interesting observation about how Genesis uses genealogies or Toledot to condense and highlight significant eras
yes.
rather than adhere to strict linear timelines.
It's a reminder that the Bible is not a history textbook in the modern sense.
Right.
But a complex and layered text with multiple layers of meaning and interpretation,
mm-hmm.
archaeology can help us unlock those layers,
yeah.
providing a richer and more nuanced understanding of the world in which the Bible was written.
All right, so we've covered a lot of ground in part one of our deep dive.
Yeah.
From the basic principles of archaeology mm-hmm. to those aha moments that make this field so fascinating.
Definitely. So picking up where we left off, imagine you're an archaeologist standing on the edge of a tell, that layered cake of history, ready to start digging. What are the first steps? The things you absolutely cannot mess up.
Yeah, it's not like you just grab a shovel and start hacking away, right? I mean, there's got to be a system, a method to the madness.
Absolutely. Remember those bulks we talked about, those borders between the excavation squares?
They're
like vertical timelines showing how the layers of the site built up over time. Dr. Hudon really emphasized the importance of meticulously removing those layers one by one, like peeling back the pages of a history book.
It's like you're trying to reverse engineer the whole process of how the site was built and lived in layer by layer.
Exactly. And within those layers, archaeologists are looking for any subtle changes in the soil color texture or the types of artifacts they find. Those subtle clues can be like signposts pointing to different periods of occupation or even specific events like a fire or a flood.
So it's not just about what you find, but where you find it in the layers. It's all about context, right?
Absolutely. The exact location and depth of every artifact are meticulously recorded, creating a three-dimensional map of the site.
Yeah.
It's like those connect-the-dots puzzles. But instead of a picture, you're revealing a story, a moment frozen in time.
Okay, but those layers don't always stack up neatly, do they? I mean, what happens when later inhabitants dig into the older layers, maybe to build a new foundation or bury something? Doesn't that mess up the whole timeline?
It definitely complicates things. Dr. Uden explained how those intrusions, as they're called, can cut through the older layers, creating a more interwoven stratigraphy. It's like having multiple timelines running through each other, and archaeologists have to be like detectives untangling the threads to understand the sequence of events.
I guess that's where those destruction layers we talked about earlier come in handy. They're like those dramatic plot twists that suddenly change everything.
They certainly add a sense of drama to the archaeological record. Remember, destruction layers are those moments when a site is suddenly and violently destroyed, whether by fire, earthquake, or human conflict.
And since they essentially freeze a moment in time, they're incredibly valuable for understanding daily life, right? Like what people were doing, what they were eating, even what they were wearing at the moment disaster struck.
Exactly. Imagine excavating a destruction layer and finding cooking pots still containing food or tools abandoned mid-task, or even personal items like jewelry or toys. It's like getting a glimpse into the lives of these people just before their world was turned upside down.
Okay, that gives me chills. It makes you realize how fragile life can be, how quickly things can change. But let's get back to the process of the dig. We've carefully excavated our layers, recorded everything, and now we have a mountain of artifacts. What happens next?
Well, the excavation is just the first step. The real detective work begins back in the lab where those artifacts are cleaned, cataloged, and analyzed.
Yeah.
This process can take months, even years, depending on the size and complexity of the dig.
So it's not all Indiana Jones-style adventure. There's a lot of painstaking lab work involved.
Absolutely. And this is where the collaboration with different specialists becomes crucial. You might have ceramic experts analyzing pottery styles, zooarchaeologists studying animal bones, paleobotanists examining plant remains, a whole team of experts working together to extract as much information as possible from these fragments of the past.
It's like a CSI team for ancient history.
That's a great way to put it. And their findings help us answer those key questions we talked about earlier. Who lived here? How did they live? Why was the site abandoned?
Okay, so we've touched on pottery quite a bit, but I want to go back to it because Dr. Huden really emphasized the importance of pottery analysis in biblical archaeology. He went way beyond just identifying styles and dates. What else can we learn from those broken shards?
One fascinating aspect is how pottery can be used to reconstruct ancient trade networks by analyzing the chemical composition of the clay and comparing it to known sources. Archaeologists can pinpoint where a particular pot was made.
So you could find a piece of pottery in Jerusalem and discover that it was actually made in Cyprus or Egypt. That's amazing.
Exactly. And that tells us something about the connections and cultural exchange between these regions. The movement of goods and ideas across vast distances.
Okay, so pottery reveals trade routes. What else?
Well, the shape and size of the vessels can tell us a lot about how they were used and what kinds of food or liquids they contained. It's a window into ancient diets and culinary practices.
So archaeologists can basically figure out what people were eating thousands of years ago just by looking at the shape of their pots. That's incredible.
It is. And sometimes pottery can even reveal insights into religious beliefs and practices. Certain types of vessels might have been used specifically for ritual purposes, or they might bear decorations with religious symbolism.
It's like those broken shards are whispering secrets from the past, waiting for us to decipher their hidden messages.
That's a beautiful way to put it. But remember, it's not just about analyzing individual shards in isolation.
Yeah.
It's about looking at the bigger picture, the overall assemblage of pottery found at a site.
So you wouldn't just focus on finding a single Philistine pot in an Israelite settlement. You'd want to know the proportion of Philistine pottery to Israelite pottery, right? Because that tells you something about the level of interaction and cultural influence between those groups.
Exactly. It's about understanding the complex interplay of cultures and influences that shaped the ancient world.
This is all so fascinating, but I want to circle back to something Dr. Hudon mentioned earlier, that conspiracy of silence when it comes to monumental inscriptions in the Levant. Why are they so rare compared to places like Egypt or Mesopotamia?
It's a question that has puzzled archaeologists for decades. Dr. Hewden suggested that the scarcity might be due to the use of perishable materials for writing. If those important inscriptions were written on plaster wood or even papyrus, they would have decayed over time, leaving behind little or no trace.
So it's not necessarily that they weren't writing, but that what they wrote on Annan has simply vanished. It's like trying to find a message written in disappearing ink.
A great analogy. And while the lack of inscriptions can be frustrating for historians trying to piece together the details of the past, it also adds an element of mystery and intrigue.
I guess it makes those rare discoveries like the Tell Dir Allah inscription we talked about even more precious.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Each fragment of writing that survives is like a window into the mind of the people who lived in these ancient lands, their thoughts, their beliefs, their stories.
It's enough to make you want to grab a trowel and head out to the nearest archaeological site, hoping to unearth the next inscription that will illuminate the world of the Bible.
Well, while we encourage that enthusiasm, it's important to remember that archaeology is a meticulous and disciplined field requiring patience, expertise, and a deep respect for the past.
Yeah.
And as we continue our deep dive, we'll explore the challenges and rewards of this fascinating field, uncovering the stories buried beneath the sands of time. But for now, let's take a brief pause and reflect on the insights we've gleaned so far in Part 3. We'll delve further into the specifics of archaeological analysis, exploring how these fragments of the past are pieced together to create a richer and more nuanced understanding of the world of the Bible.
All right, so welcome back to our deep dive into biblical archaeology.
Yeah.
So far, we've dug into the dirt. Unearthed artifacts glimpsed the meticulous process of excavation.
Right.
But as we enter Part 3, it's time to put on our detective hats and explore the fascinating world of archaeological analysis,
yeah,
where those seemingly random fragments transform into a story.
It's amazing to think how a pile of broken pottery,
I know, right?
Or a few charred timbers,
yeah,
can reveal so much about ancient civilizations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like watching those crime scene investigation shows where they piece together tiny clues to solve a mystery.
Exactly. It's more than just cataloging and displaying artifacts.
Right.
It's about extracting meaning, understanding the stories they tell,
uh-huh,
and connecting them to the bigger picture of history.
Yeah.
So where do we even begin with this whole analysis process?
Well, the first step is a thorough examination of the artifacts themselves. What archaeologists call material analysis.
Okay.
What are they made of?
Uh-huh.
How were they crafted?
Yeah.
Do they bear any markings or decorations?
Right.
This is where those specialized experts come in.
Okay.
Like ceramicists, metallurgists, and even textile analysts.
So it's a team effort with different experts bringing their unique perspectives to the table.
Exactly.
It's like each artifact has its own language.
Yeah.
And we need the right translator to understand what it's saying.
A great analogy. And each expert can unlock a different layer of information. For example, a ceramic expert might analyze the composition of a pottery shard.
Right.
Identifying the specific type of clay used.
Uh-huh.
And potentially pinpointing its origin.
Okay.
We talked earlier about finding imported Cypriot pottery in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of analysis can confirm those trade routes and cultural connections.
Okay, so we can trace a humble cooking pot.
Yeah.
Back to a specific region.
Uh-huh.
What else can this material analysis tell us?
The shape and style of a pot.
Okay.
Any markings or decorations, all of these can reveal how it was used, what kinds of food it might have contained, even the social status of its owner.
Wow.
It's like each artifact is a puzzle piece.
Yeah.
And we're trying to fit them together to create a picture of daily life in the past.
It makes you realize how much information is embedded in these seemingly ordinary objects.
Right.
But it's not just about the artifacts themselves, right?
Mm.
We also need to understand the world around them.
Yeah.
The environment in which they were found.
Absolutely. Environmental archaeology plays a crucial role in reconstructing ancient landscapes and climates.
Okay.
By analyzing pollen grains, seeds, and animal bones.
Right.
We can determine what plants grew in the region,
uh-huh,
what animals roamed the land,
yeah,
and how these environmental factors influenced human settlements and activities.
So it's like putting together an ecological puzzle.
Right.
Figuring out how humans interacted with their natural surroundings, mm, and how those interactions shaped their culture and history.
Precisely. And speaking of preserving the past,
yeah,
sometimes the environment itself plays a role.
Okay.
We already discussed the Dead Sea Scrolls,
uh-huh,
miraculously preserved in the dry climate of those caves.
Right.
But there are other cases where extreme conditions,
okay,
intense heat, freezing temperatures, or even waterlogged environments,
yeah,
create unique preservation conditions that protect fragile organic materials that would otherwise decompose.
So it's like a time capsule sealed away for centuries waiting for us to discover it. But even with all this data, all these artifacts and environmental clues,
mm-hmm,
the challenge is to synthesize it all into a coherent narrative, right? To connect the dots and create a story.
And this is where the historian's skill set comes into play.
Okay.
Weaving together archaeological evidence with textual sources, inscriptions, and other historical data to create a multifaceted understanding of the past.
Uh-huh.
It's like a historical detective story, piecing together clues from different sources, corroborating evidence, and building a compelling case for a particular interpretation of events.
And just like in a good detective story,
yeah,
there might be twists, turns, and even dead ends along the way.
Right.
Not all archaeological evidence is straightforward.
Yeah.
And interpretations can change as new discoveries come to light.
It's a reminder that our understanding of the past is constantly evolving, always open to revision and refinement as we uncover new pieces of the puzzle. That's what makes archaeology so exciting. It's a journey of discovery, a constant quest for knowledge, and a deeper understanding of ourselves and our place in the grand sweep of history.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into biblical archaeology,
yeah,
we're left with a sense of wonder and a renewed appreciation for the power of these ancient fragments.
Mm-hmm.
The artifacts, the sites, the stories they tell, they offer us a glimpse into a world both familiar and profoundly different from our own.
And even seemingly mundane objects, a broken pottery shard, a misplaced coin, a charred timber from a long-forgotten fire, can whisper secrets about the past,
yeah,
inviting us to consider the lives and stories buried beneath our feet.
It's a powerful reminder that the past is not lost,
right,
but lives on in these fragments, waiting for us to discover, analyze, and interpret them.
Exactly.
And in doing so, we connect with those who came before us,
yeah,
gaining a deeper understanding of ourselves and our own place in the unfolding tapestry of time.